Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Ocean and everyone. It's an honor to be here. We do love this place. One of the tragedies of speaking in conferences and gatherings is everybody is coming with so much chaos in their brain, and you're supposed to speak to them. So it's really great to know that you're speaking to a group of people who have been sitting in stillness for the last 45 minutes or hour. And I actually, often I've realized that I need to slow people down before I speak to them because I want to be in dialogue with some very like core part in them. And so I've started having them meditate with me in colleges and at these conferences. And what I'll do, and this is very brief, you've been meditating for a while now, and I know, like me and all of you, didn't entertain any thoughts of the past or future for the last 45 minutes, just pure being. So I'm going to invite you to close your eyes for a moment and actually evoke the past. And the thing that I'm going to ask you to evoke, I'm still breathing deeply, is your favorite dinner party ever. And hopefully something comes to mind. If not, just invent one, what it should look like, so it'll be the future. And think about just a few elements of that dinner. Who was there? Maybe there's some memory of what was served, or the smell, or the taste of the food, or how it came together last minute, or how it was very intentional. Just kind of evoke that experience a little bit and some of the feelings that it gives you, like some of your favorite people might have been at the table, and maybe it went late into the night or it was in some exotic location. So as you're just kind of thinking about that, we'll just open our eyes and come back together. This is, hopefully there's some like very meaningful thing that happens to you when you think about a dinner that had real significance to you. Because a lot of people ask us, why death and dinner? Like, pretty strange bedfellows. Almost antithetical, right? One nourishes you and one takes away life. And for me, I've seen dinner as this very central, very vulnerable, very powerful part of the human experience, a very powerful ritual where we can come to know ourselves if it's well manifest. And just a little background. We'll get into what death over dinner is exactly. It's not murder theater. Murder dinner theater. There's no Agatha Christie, gotcha at the end. But what it is a invitation and permission and the framework, essentially the ritual structure for people to have a dinner with loved ones or friends or even strangers to talk about end of life and mortality. People they've lost. So it could be grief, it could be somebody dealing with a terminal illness. It could be just being prepared or wanting to have a hard conversation because as our new friend who we did a death meditation with, an evening with here recently, Michael Mead, another islander, likes to remind us as an Irish proverb that is, death is what happens in the middle of a long life. which is another one of those kind of strange paradoxes, but what I take from that proverb is in order to fully live is to face the fact that we're mortal, and that's where some people say death is the birth of philosophy and the birth of religion and many things. But first, to talk about dinner and why dinner, because that's probably the odd thing out. I've been gathering people around the table for about 20 years, realizing came from a project when I left architecture school. I started building tea houses and as a gathering place, because I'm down in Portland, a project called City Repair, partnered with an architect named Mark Lakeman. And he had already started this project, but he brought me in as a partner in it. And I got to see how profoundly the yearning and longing, how profound it was for people to be together and to have some significant reason to be together, and how we'd taken away gathering places and tea houses and rituals from just our regular mundane world. and put it only within a religious context. And so from realizing that, and the amount of work it took to build a tea house and to build these things and the power of it, I realized that the dinner table is essentially a ready-made object that has all of this history and all of this importance, and it's sitting in our living rooms or dining rooms, and most of us don't know how to use it. It's almost like, and sometimes we don't use it, and some houses have done away with it. I think a lot of houses. and the couch has become where people have dinner. And so when I realized that there's this yearning, there's this lack of ritual, the fact that 20% of American meals are eaten in a car, is, how far we've gone from understanding and maintaining and the dinner at the core of our culture. So I got really curious and started doing research and say, why the dinner table? Why does it have so much importance to me? And why, why does it hurt me so bad that it's just been forgotten? And this is the state of it. And one of the most important things I came across was the fact that eating together and cooking together is what made us human. So Dr. Richard Wrangham, who I had the pleasure of doing some dinners with, who's the chief anthropological biologist at Harvard, he disproved Darwin. Darwin's theory was that we became human, took the leap from ape to human by hunting and eating animals and eating meat. And that was what made these physiological changes. And what Wrangham showed was concentrating calories over fire is actually what gave us that jump. And we used to have very big bellies. An ape chews 7 hours a day. We chew 24 minutes a day. So we took these big bellies and essentially just, exported them to the fire, which is doing the work that our belly used to be. And we had all of this, energy that was freed up, and it went to growing a really big brain. So it was an exchange between belly and size and brain size. And this all happened while cooking together and sharing food around a fire, all things that animals don't do, right? So it's like, okay, so eating together in the table, and then kind of interestingly, when you would roast and meat, you roasted it at about the height of a table. It's almost that table sight line is already in our consciousness from a very early period. And so I was like, okay, so eating together is tied to our evolution and genetically. It's deep within our DNA. And then started to look through historically and see that the table has been this incredible spark for evolution, but also a container for culture. So if you look through and say what kind of innovation, you look at Benjamin Franklin and the Lunar Men, Jason Priestley, they had gatherings once a month on the full moon, and this is literally where the discovery of oxygen, it's air itself, was discovered and understood via these dinners. Or if you think about some of the the dinner parties that Gertrude Stein threw. And so I started to get really interested in this cultural spark that the dinner table had. And then since we're in the Havara, the great example in the Jewish tradition is the Seder. And after the temple was destroyed in 80 AD, or I guess we say CE now, but there was a great tragedy and a great kind of problem within the Jewish faith. How do we continue Passover without a temple? It's a temple-based religion. People would travel for days and months to be at the temple in Jerusalem for Passover. And this is at the time when Hellenism and Greek culture was very, very hot. It was very in vogue. And the Symposium, where Plato and Socrates and et cetera had these dinners, that model was literally taken by the rabbis and said, well, what if we slip Passover into a Seder dinner, which at the time was heretical. You don't bring that kind of forcep into your home within the Jewish tradition at that time. It's like, well, if we put it in there, kind of sneak it away, you know, as a kind of castaway, could it survive this tragedy within our culture? And it has. It's, you know, how many millions of people. So we started to look at the fact that it is this place of evolution, but also this container of culture. The dinner is kind of secretly just sitting there. And then realized that our approach to death in this culture has been to medicalize it and to separate ourselves from it. I think of it in a lot of the same way of what we've done with birth. So luckily, we've learned to start to demedicalize birth. Essentially, as I'm sure everyone knows, birth was taken away from women and midwives and put into this medical context in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and we realized that the damages that come from really over-medicalizing that situation. And we've done the same thing for death. 75% of people want to die at home, and 25% of them do in this country. And so that was really the statistic that made us realize that there was kind of a perfect storm, a situation where people weren't getting what they wanted in this country at the end of their life. Some of their most important wishes weren't being respected, heard, activated, thought out, in a country that is all about individualism. It's all about the fact, the freedom of choice, and half of us aren't getting what we want. And so, you know, why is that? And so we decided that in order to change things, it wasn't going to come from our insurance providers, because they're terrified of having us talk about end of life. It looks like they want to educate us so that we want less service. Politicians, death panels, all of these things came up. And so it became very clear that we needed to inspire families and individuals, both in the U.S. and now internationally, as Koshin mentioned, to have this conversation and to give them the tools to do it. And it's been pretty extraordinary. There's been about 100,000 dinners in the last 2 years. And we are going to Sendai, and we're going to Australia, and we're working on a doctors and nurses edition. But that's kind of the framework for why dinner and why end of life and how this idea came together. And it was just offered as a gift. We created it at University of Washington just to give it to culture, to say, like, hey, here's some tools. But I'm going to pass it over to Angel.
My fire in having to do this work comes from, I was raised in South Carolina, and in South Carolina and in the South, repression and non-expression, not speaking uncomfortable things, is just the way it is. Right? Is that how it was in North Carolina? How where you grew up? My dad died in 2004, and it happened pretty quickly. He had cancer. He was diagnosed with cancer, and they gave him a year to live. And 5 weeks later, he died. And so in those 5 weeks, he declined really fast, and it was obvious that he was not going to live for a year. But during those 5 weeks, all of our family was around, and he ended up coming home. But nobody was saying, he's dying. Like, and it was actually like, if you even talked a little bit like that, then somebody would get mad, you know, out of our little family of, like, you know, 12 people there, somebody would get mad and be like, don't talk like that. It's like, well, he just lost 40 pounds. And he wasn't like a big, you know, like, this kind of stuff. And so after he died, I promised myself that I would never go through a death like that again. A big part of the work that I do and that I've been doing before when I met Michael, I was doing, is about healing emotional needs. you know, an emotional healing with people. And so when I, you know, I read in the China study, have you guys heard of that, the China study? It's a, at the time they did it, it was the biggest healthcare study ever. And it's, there's a book that was published probably about 10 or 12 years ago that I read back then. But I recently remembered hearing in the China study that there had been a link found between breast cancer and repressed anger. And so I just started researching that on Google, breast cancer, repressed anger. And it turned up that there have been, for the past 5 decades that I have found, research studies going back to the early 60s, linking cancer with repressed emotions and with repressed, you know, not speaking, not talking about the hard things, not having these conversations. And so, so I wanted to, I have a funny story for you. So speaking about repression, our printer is out of ink. And so this morning I was like, oh, I'm going to have to bring my laptop in to read this studies. And I got all like, I was walking in and never told Koshin this, but he looks like a younger version of the Southern Baptist preacher that I grew up going to church every weekend with. So the first time I ever met him, like I had been coming to the morning sits for a little bit before I met him. And when he walked in, I remember getting tense and feeling like shrinking a little bit. And it was like David Blizzard all over again, who told me that, like, you're going to burn in hell, you know. And so this morning when I was like, oh, I'm going to have to take my computer to tell him about the studies. And I walked in and the coach is standing there, who I know is very kind and compassionate. And but I was like, had my purse and I got all awkward, you know. And I was like, I have to bring my notes in. And I was like shrinking, you know. And so I noticed that as it was happening, I was like, wow, that is the repression in my cells going, I am inappropriate. I'm doing something wrong, you know. So I'm going to open up my I just wanted to share specifically with you a couple of studies, just to give you a little depth of what's going on here. So a study involving 847 U.S. women diagnosed with invasive breast cancer were studied for 9 years by the California Department of Health Services and National Cancer Institute to see whether emotional expression affected cancer survival rates. And the report said that patients who reported low levels of emotional expression experienced worse survival than women who reported high levels. Women with early stage tumors had a nearly fourfold risk of dying from breast cancer if they reported low levels of emotional expression. So then another one is that a study published in the Journal of Psychosomatic Research found that men with lung cancer, quote, have poor and restricted outlets for the expression of emotion as compared with non-malignancy lung patients in normal controls. I'll give you two more. The California Breast Cancer Research Program conducted a follow-up study of a 1989 study and found the survival rate of women in a group therapy program who openly expressed their anger. Their survival rate was doubled compared to women in the same group therapy program who constrained their anger. And then, let's see here which one I want to choose. In a landmark study conducted by the Department of Psychology, University of Miami, researchers found men with prostate cancer who had greater suppression of anger had fewer numbers of natural killer cells, which are the key immune system cells for fighting cancer. Yeah. So what happens is when we suppress our emotions and when we don't have those hard conversations, our stress hormone cortisol increases, right? And so we get flooded with it, and that directly suppresses our immune functioning. And the short version of this, I have a whole long thing of all the things it depletes when that happens, from melatonin to tryptophan to all of these things that are depleted. just neurologically and throughout our whole body. But what eventually happens is that over time, with the immune system not functioning properly, normal cells mutate into cancer cells. And so this work is very personal, you know, to being alive. And one thing that I realized on my own path, you know, I left the South and I was like, okay, that is not working for me. That wasn't working. And many years ago, I started meditating and practicing yoga and teaching and doing all this stuff. And then it took me about 10 years to realize that I was using my practice as another form of repression. Because I thought that if I could just like work on it in here, I didn't have to say anything to anybody else. And then, you know, when Michael and I, started living together about 3 years ago, I had decided that that was not, that I couldn't live like, you know, like that anymore. And so Michael and our relationship has been like the guinea pig of my self-expression. And not just mine, but both of us having, and so it's one of our foundational practices of having these difficult conversations and not just like...
I was fully self-expressed.
I know you were. You know, he grew up in the Northwest where everybody's so heart wide open. But, you know, my point of all of it is that yeah, like it's amazing that this cultural movement is happening and all of this stuff, but it's happening, in my opinion, because that resonates on a heart level with me, is because we're all hungry for connection in this, like, in this physical realm. We're hungry for open connection. And when we don't have it, it's killing us. So that's why I think that maybe, you know, if you want to have a death over dinner for your own, or drugs over dinner, that's a good idea.